This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour. This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hellfire is surrounding the disbelievers.
Okay.
A person needs to go no further except to go outside and to look into the sky during the day and to feel the heat from the sun, and to realize that the sun is a ball of fire. Every day it is surrounding the disbelievers. Every day it is in the sky, passing by. The sun is hellfire. أعوذ من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد إليما المهدينا وسلم تسليما السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته my dear sister Tiffany
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته dear father thank you for having me back today
God bless you thank you for being here so today we want to talk about the hereafter and specifically about heaven and hell this concept in Judaism Christianity and Islam all religions in general they have an emphasis on the hereafter. And they all sought to answer that question, where is it that we go after we die? And pretty much most of them have a system that is just one or two few odd exceptions if you're going to add in there some Afro-Brazilian religions and things of the sort. But for the most part, all of them have this idea that if you do good in this world, you are rewarded in the next. Okay. That there is a next, whether that next appears in the form of reincarnation, as is in Buddhism or Hinduism, or the next is a place which is called heaven or hell. Like in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. In Judaism, there's not a whole lot of literature or writings about the concept of heaven and hell. There's not too much about it. But we do know that they considered that the dead would go into the belly of the earth. And there's many examples of this. And even when Saul uses the witch, the necromancer, to summon the soul of Samuel, she summons him out of the earth. Okay? And we do know also that Jesus, who was living, in Judea, he was living in Israel, and he was a Jew, that he did believe in a heaven and a hell, and he talked about it extensively. And the Jews that followed him, they accepted this, and for that reason it is fair to say that the concept of heaven and hell existed with Jews in Jerusalem and in the surrounding areas way before Jesus Christ. Yeah. We know that there's a word that Jesus used to describe hell, and that was Jahannah, which later in Arabic is Jahannam, and Jahannah was actually a place that he had pointed towards when he was talking to hell with his disciples. And he was saying that the souls would burn in the hereafter that were evil in Jahannam. And this area was a gigantic garbage dump that was always set on fire to burn the trash. And so this concept of fire being associated with the place of hellfire, was one that was evident and present in Christianity, and that term that is so well known in Islam also originated with Jesus Christ, if not before him, but that's the first time that we really see it being used, you know, in basically in modern literature.
Okay. That's interesting.
It is interesting. And Jesus also spoke about the heavenly realms, and we do have in the Gospels a description of a place in the book of Revelation where the throne of God exists, and next to him is the Lamb, and surrounding the throne there are these cherubim, these angels, which we spoke about in a previous episode. And then you have these 24 elders, which there's not much that's said about them, but we'll go into them in a future topic. But basically, there's also this description of this heavenly host, or these angels that exist in the heavens up above, alongside the Father and Jesus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
And the idea is that man, when he disobeys God, he deserves to go to the place of Jahannam, the place of hellfire, as a punishment, because nobody who has sin on him can exist in a place that is meant for perfection and for the obedient. Right? And so in order for a person to go and be in the presence of God, he has to get rid of this sin. Now, people, they contemplated and they wondered forever, for as long as mankind had these ideas, or as long as the prophets and the messengers spoke about these realms or these places, they contemplated and they guessed over the location of heaven and hell. Okay, well, where are these places? And in Judaism and Christianity, the implication seems to be that hellfire is in the belly of the earth, that it's in the inside. And there's the reasons for that are certain narrations or verses that imply that the souls of the damned get swallowed by the earth and they're stuck within the belly of the earth. And we see that some of the villains also, when they were sent away or go to hell, that they're swallowed into the earth, like Korah, for example, who was opposing Moses and his party.
Yes.
And we spoke also about how when Saul summoned the soul of Samuel using the necromancer, that she summons him out of the belly of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have literature that's outside of the New Testament and the Old Testament that speak about the concept of the harrowing of hell, which is a really extremely fascinating story and concept. And it is the idea that, so when Jesus got crucified in Christianity,
yes,
you know, it says basically that he goes into the belly of the earth.
Yeah.
For how long?
For 3 days.
For 3 days.
Yeah.
And this is what it says. It doesn't really say anything else in the New Testament. It just makes this comparison between Jesus's being buried in the ground, right? Or dying for 3 days, in between Jonah being swallowed by the whale for 3 days.
Yeah, as he said, you'll be given the sign of Jonah. And
And then later on, people sought to explain the events that took place in the absence of Jesus during these 3 days. Would you like to share that story?
Just that he descended, as you said, he descended into the pits of hellfire, and he unchained the people there, so he set them free, and then he came back, and this is when he makes his reappearance.
So the souls were set free. They thought to themselves, okay, well, what was Jesus doing there during these 3 days? So then they came up with this story, and the narration state that Basically, Jesus, after he dies, he descends and he goes into hell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because if heaven is up, then hell has to be
below,
down.
Yes.
And for them, they didn't know that the earth was round back then. They thought that the earth was flat.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So down must mean not space underneath the planet, but it must be down into the belly of the earth.
Okay.
Because for them, you know, you can keep going forever to the left, you can keep going forever to the right, and you know, there's land, so up is sky, down is earth.
Yes.
So where's hell? Hell must be down. It can't be up. So where is down? Down is in the belly of the earth. This is where this concept of hell being downwards in the earth came from.
Yes, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they said that Jesus goes down and he basically smashes the doors, the gates of hell open. Why? Because before him, everybody who did not believe in the resurrected Jesus, according to Christian theology, they had no chance, because the only way that you can go to heaven is if you believe in Christ, because he says, I'm the way, I'm the life.
Yes.
And they had already issued fatwas and said that this is the only way. Anybody who doesn't, it goes to hell. And even in Catholicism, unbaptized babies that are not baptized, where do they go, Tiffany?
Hell.
They go to hell.
Yeah.
All right. So for anybody to go to heaven, they have to be baptized in Christ.
Okay.
And then this caused a problem and a question. Okay, well, what about all of our ancestors that came before?
Okay.
What happened to them?
Yes.
Okay. Well, naturally, they're in hell, right?
Yeah.
Because, well, then, okay, well, what happened to the prophets and the messengers? Well, even the prophets and the messengers in some of the Christian narrations, all of those who came before Christ, they got stuck somewhere in the belly of the earth, not necessarily in the pits of hell, but they definitely didn't ascend to the Father or go up to heaven, right?
Yes.
So they're all stuck there. And they use this idea that Samuel was in the earth to show that clearly, look, he didn't ascend like Jesus ascended. Jesus is the first to ascend up to heaven. And so Jesus had unfinished business that he had to take care of. What did he have to do? He had to go down. He had to save his ancestors. He had to pull out the souls of Isaac and Abraham and Jacob and Joseph and the rest of the prophets and the messengers and save everybody that didn't have a chance of being saved.
Okay, so this is the explanation for that conundrum of, you know, two things. Where was he in those 3 days, and what happened to the souls who had come before, even the pure souls? Like, how would they have a chance at salvation?
Exactly. So he goes down, he busts open the gates of hell, and he offers salvation to all those who were dead. Now, all of the souls that basically believed in him or jumped at the chance to come out of hell or to come out of the earth, which is pretty much most of them, right? They end up being saved. And that's why in the movie of The Passion of the Christ, you have this scene where after Jesus' crucifixion, you know, Mel Gibson places, there's this cut scene where it goes to hell and you find Satan is standing there and he's yelling. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah.
He's like screaming.
Yeah.
Why is he screaming? Because hell's empty.
Yeah.
All of his work, all of the people that he's been collecting, all the souls that he gathered and he placed in hell, now they're gone. Jesus came down, he emptied the hellfire, and everybody went up.
Yeah.
Okay. So you get the idea now.
Yes.
So in Judaism, hell is downwards.
Yes.
In the earth,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And heaven is up above.
Yes.
And the same thing in Christianity.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Jesus is lifted, you know, into the sky. So, yeah, naturally, it would be, that's where he's being taken, to the heavens.
Exactly. And the Gnostics, Tiffany, they believed that the heavenly realm, where everybody should aspire to go to, exists beyond, you know, the planets, into the area where you could see all of the stars in the night sky.
Okay.
They believed, some Gnostics believed that that there was this system, that there were these archons, these evil rulers of the earth that were essentially demons. demons that were helpers of Azazel and that had influence over this realm, the earthly realm, and they helped Azazel build the physical realm, and that they were basically traps. They would entrap the souls from ascending to heaven, and they would stop the souls as they were on their way up. They would question them. If the souls couldn't give them the right answers, then they must descend back down. And for that reason, the Gnostics believed that salvation cannot be attained through belief, but it had to be attained through knowledge, because it's this knowledge that you would need as you're on your way up. And when you're questioned by the archons, you would need this knowledge in order that you not be thrown back down into the belly of the earth.
Yes. Yeah.
And they believed that these archons were basically the different heavenly bodies that they saw. So they believed that the sun, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, these seven were the seven archons that were kind of each one guards a certain doorway.
Okay.
And so you have to pass through these seven layers of the heaven until you reach like the eternal place of heaven where all of the stars or all of the good souls abide.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And so they'd travel up, the moon would come, and the moon is actually an archon, so it would question the soul. If the soul answers and manages to pass, you know, pass by it, then it still has to face these other planetary bodies or heavenly bodies.
That's fascinating in light of what we know about the celestial bodies. And it's very, very interesting. You know, they're beings, they're like you said, the word demon, like spirits that are like gatekeepers essentially of the heavens.
Exactly. Gatekeepers of the heavens. And then you come to Islam, and Islam also has the concept, and they wrote about it a lot more than the Christians and the Jews wrote about it. And the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, many more of his narrations and his hadith, him and his holy household survived that, described in great detail these places.
Yeah.
So there is another place in Catholicism that's kind of like a waiting area, right?
Yeah.
What's it called?
Purgatory.
Purgatory.
Yeah, it's like a middle, like a state of limbo for people to work off their sins that they've accumulated. In order to receive, hopefully, access to heaven.
And it's interesting to note that the word purgatory comes from the Latin purgatorium, and this was an area where the Romans when they would get drunk, that they would puke. It was a center that they would all go to, and it was a vomiting center, so to speak. Mm. And so the name, because the New Testament is all written in Latin, right?
Mm.
So the name that was given to this in Christian writings was named after this place, whereby it's a place where after a person dies, he can vomit out or, you know,
purge your sins.
Purge
interesting.
Sins, right? Okay, so let's move on. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he's describing heaven and hell. He's speaking about them in great detail. He's describing, and the Quran is describing hell as a place of eternal damnation, and he's describing it as a fire.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, hellfire.
Hellfire, and he calls it Jahannam. Mm. And this hellfire, when we look into the hadiths, we find that there are many forms of torture and punishment that's taking place. Specific forms of torture for specific sins. For example, the man who is a fornicator. In some narrations and writings, his male organ would be stretched out, and he would be bit repeatedly by certain serpents of hellfire. that were made for that specific, duty to punish the souls of the damned. A woman, for example, who's a fornicator, she, in certain narrations, basically would have, coal or burning staffs of burning fire that would be placed inside of her organs to punish her for the fornication that she had done. People that used to backbite, for example, in hellfire, they would be gnawing and eating the flesh of their brothers and their sisters, or people that, human beings that they used to backbite. So they would be literally eating them, or their tongues would be stretched out and would be cut off or tormented in certain ways. And this description of hellfire, it does parallel Christian writings and descriptions of hell. And we have an example of that in Dante's Inferno, whereby Dante is describing the different circles of hell, and each circle of hell belongs to a particular group of sinners. There's a circle of hell that's for those who were condemned because of gluttony. There's a circle of hell for those who are condemned because of murder. There's a circle of hell for those who are condemned because of treachery and deceit, lying, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And similarly, the same way as the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, was speaking, Dante's Inferno and other Christian writings are describing, and even though it's a fictitious story, Dante's Inferno is based on other Christian writings that are not as popular, and teachings within the church from the hundreds of years before that described hell and the different layers that are in there. And you can see in the book, and also in the play or in the video game of Dante's Inferno, how they have placed also these types of punishments, whereby people that, for example, were in there because of eating too much or gluttony, they continue to eat until they explode, or different types of things. They have in there also, in Dante's Inferno, a scene where in one of the lowest levels of hellfire, alongside with Satan, or right before Satan, you have the Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali. And this is something that maybe not so many Muslims know about the story of Dante's Inferno. And the author, he wrote the story in a time, or the play in a time, where Islam was hated, and it was the arch nemesis of Europe, right? And Christianity and the church. And so it describes how the Prophet Muhammad had his chest split open, and he was walking around, and his intestines and organs are falling out. And so this was supposed to be a punishment for him, because obviously he was claiming that he was receiving revelations in his chest from God. But because they said that he was a liar and a false prophet, this was his punishment, to walk around with his chest open and his organs hanging out, also because of, what they deemed to be the various sexual sins that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam had committed. And ahead of him was this man who they call him Ali, right? And so that's interesting, because that also shows that they were not just familiar with Sunni Islam, but also Shia Islam. And they said that Ali is sitting there, and he's basically like slapping his head for all eternity, covering his face, weeping, saying, "Woe to me," basically in a state of regret, because he followed the false prophet and gave him victory.
Okay, wow. That's kind of shocking. Yeah.
So it is shocking, but the point of displaying these stories is that both Christianity and Islam have this concept that because of the deeds that led you into hellfire, or the nature of the deeds that led you into hellfire, would play a part in the way that you are punished for all eternity.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. Display of justice, essentially. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's also stated that there are angels that are in hellfire, actually, and that are in charge of hellfire. And they are the ones that are repeatedly tormenting those, you know, poor souls who end up there. It is possible that in Islam that souls exit out of hellfire once being placed inside. And this takes place in many narrations whereby the souls of the damned are interceded for by believers or by certain prophets and messengers who make dua or ask God to forgive them, and then they're taken out. And in Al-Haftar Sharif, for example, there is the greater punishment and there's the lesser punishment. And so just like there's this concept of the hereafter in Hinduism and Buddhism that involves a period of reincarnations, in Al-Haftar Sharif, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam narrates that the meaning of the lesser punishment, because in the Quran there's this mentioning of a lesser punishment and a greater punishment.
Yes.
And so Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam explains that the lesser punishment are these reincarnations.
Okay.
Or masakh, that a person reincarnates in a state of punishment or in a state as an animal. Mainly, but he also could come back as a rock or an inanimate object, or could come back as a plant, or come back as a human being who is disabled or has some sort of, you know, really difficult life. And the greater punishment, he says, is the hellfire.
Okay.
And the hellfire in the Haftar Sharif doesn't last forever, but rather it lasts for, you know, about a maximum of 50,000 years. And then after that, it's emptied out, and those souls that were once in hellfire end up coming back as ants and insects and little creatures and critters that crawl on the earth, and then they have to work their way up again into higher forms of, you know, or greater forms of animals until they eventually reach the ability to have a human body once again. So it's this cycle of, it's a never-ending cycle whereby hell is not exactly like the final place, but rather it's this gigantic school and system whereby souls are purified, you know, and they have to suffer and learn and pay their karmic debt until they eventually qualify to enter into the higher kingdoms above.
Okay. Okay. That's very interesting. I always thought about these things as final, like eternal. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And there's a lot of regeneration of bodies that's mentioned in the narrations in hellfire, because the place is, after all, fire. Right?
Yes.
So it mentions how these bodies are basically melted and the body regenerates once again. And then as they're being tortured, it melts once again, and it's a continuous process. The drinks that exist in hellfire are quite nasty. People want to drink something, but they can't find anything to drink. So the only things that are available are pus and blood and basically lava and things of this nature, which basically burns the insides of the human being. And they're begging the people of heavens, people of hellfire can always see the people of heaven, and they're begging them to, you know, let loose. You have also in hellfire the people that are, so there's lots of people that drag other people into hellfire. You know, and that's why the Prophet warns us of the types of people that we hang out with in life, right? Because if you want to know where it is that you're going to go, You just need to look at those people that you are hanging out with, because a person is always resurrected with those whom he loves, or those whom he hangs out with. And so birds of a feather flock together, in other words. And so there are people that end up being false shepherds, or being tempters, so to speak, and they tempt people into sin or lead them astray. Those people in the hellafter, in the hereafter, in hellfire, they end up being stomped and beaten and attacked and ripped apart by all those who are in there because of them. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So like if you have, for example, a false cult leader or a non-working scholar who leads a bunch of people astray, in the hereafter, all those people, they turn against him.
Okay.
And they participate in the punishment against this individual.
Okay.
And then you have the descriptions of paradise, which is the opposite. And it is described as a place of blessings, where there's rivers that are flowing, rivers of milk, rivers of honey, rivers of wine. All things are acceptable in paradise. You have in there these houris that are in paradise, and their sole purpose is to basically be concubines to the males who have entered into paradise. And those things which were not allowed on earth become allowed in paradise.
Yeah.
You know, so wine in Islam is not allowed on earth. In the hereafter, wine is allowed. On earth, you can only take 4 wives. In paradise, you can have 70 concubines, right? Or 72 concubines.
Yes.
And in some cases, in some narrations or schools of thought, an endless amount of concubines. It doesn't say whether or not the concubines are only for men, or are they also for women. And Imam Ahmad Hassan Salam, we had a conversation about this once, and he clarified that the concubines are for the men and for the women, because paradise is this realm whereby a person receives anything it is that he desires or he wants. So if there's a woman who desires or wants one of these hura'in, then she can have it. And their skin is being described as extremely fair. In some narrations, they're described as being like pearls, extremely white. Or even a see-through to the point that their bone marrow is showing, and their beauty is something that is out of this world. The beauty of the Hurain, the Huris in paradise, is not comparable to any woman that exists or lives on this physical earth, and they are women that. In some narrations, they grow on trees, and if we take obviously the meaning of the allegory of a tree, in that it is a strong believer. If the as we spoke about the goal of the wise and before in some of the episodes that are on this channel, that the tree in paradise or in that world represents a believer. So growing on trees would be basically that are created from some of these strong believers are these Hurain.
Wow.
And these Huris had never come down to the earth. They never incarnated before. They're aware of who they're assigned to on the earth. It says in narrations that they are always asking God that the individual, looking forward to the day that the individual that they're assigned to passes on, so that they can be with them over there in paradise. And the narrations did state that the females, the earthly females, so women that did live on earth, that ended up in paradise, that their beauty in paradise exceeds by a long shot the beauty even of the Houris.
Okay.
All right. So the most beautiful people in paradise are the believers.
Oh.
And Ahmed Hassan Salam, he states that the beauty in paradise is based on faith. So okay. Everybody that's in paradise is beautiful. Everybody that's in paradise is young. But how beautiful you are, this depends on your faith. And that then it becomes this kind of ranking system in paradise where everybody's able to know who is the best. You know, who is the highest, and who is the best and who is the highest is based on the physical beauty that they have.
Wow.
With obviously Fatima al-Zahra, alayhi salam, Muhammad the Prophet, David, Jesus, the other prophets being like all the most beautiful creatures in paradise.
Can't even imagine. Oh, amazing.
Yeah. Then you have this other thing in paradise, which is these wildan mukhalladun, these everlasting youth, these immortal boys. And the immortal boys concept is kind of like the opposite of the Houris. It's the same thing, but the male version of it. Where there are these young men or young boys that are going around and they're serving alcohol or serving drinks, serving fruits, performing other services, being kind of the male version of the concubine for the inhabitants of paradise.
Okay.
Whether they're males or whether they're females. And so there's this aspect of the permissibility of homosexuality that is implied in the narrations as a reward for those whom would desire such a thing, that abstained from it on earth but are allowed it in paradise.
And it
is interesting. And it's interesting too that this idea of immortal boys is kind of also reflected in the ancient Greco-Roman art, where you find these little boys or these babies or these youth that have these wings that are in these realms up above, that Cupid ends up being kind of like the archetype for them.
Yeah.
But you have these other drawings of them. And obviously, you know, this idea didn't start with Islam, but rather it predated Islam, that there are these young boys that, you know, exist in the higher realms. And we do know that the Greeks and the Romans, they did have this culture that they're elite and they're used to basically have young boys as sexual servants for them, or there would be this relationship between the teacher and between the young boy, which was sexual in nature. And so this idea carries on and exists in the Islamic narration of paradise or heaven.
Okay.
And these young men or young boys are there, obviously, at the service of not just other men, but also of women. So whoever it is that desires them, in the same way that the Houris are there for whoever it is that desires them.
Okay.
And they also never came down to the earth.
Okay.
Now, it's interesting because some narrations say that actually, who are these Wildan Mukhalladun? They're not actually people that never came down or creatures that were created specifically only for paradise. But these Wildan Mukhalladun are all of the babies that died before their age of being judged, right? Mm-hmm. So like all children that die and they're still, you know, in their prepubescent years before puberty, where do they go if they're Christians or if they're Jews or if they're Hindus or if they're Buddhists, right?
Yeah.
So in Christianity, the answer to that, that's the same question is being posed to every religion, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if somebody rejects the religion, where do they go? They go to hellfire. But what if they're a child?
Yeah.
Where do they go, right?
Yeah.
You know, so presumably Christians say, yeah, well, if they're not baptized, they go to hellfire.
Yeah.
The Catholics at least
exactly
do, right? And they end up being, you know, just creatures that are in there. And for Islam, that doesn't really make sense, that the children go to hellfire because of that. And so the answer is the opposite.
Okay, because they're sinless. Yeah.
Yeah, they're sinless. Yeah. So they go to heaven.
Okay.
All right. But they're servants of heaven.
Okay.
They don't get to just enjoy heaven as like a king, but rather they're still in heaven. They're still enjoying it, but they're servants.
Yeah.
Okay, why? Because they didn't say the Shahada, they didn't say Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah.
They're sinless, and yet they didn't go through the test of belief that people must pass through. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
And obviously, like, there's many different schools of thoughts and many different viewpoints, and they differ. You know, not everybody's going to agree on the same thing, but there are these narrations and these viewpoints that are out there in regards to that. What else exists in paradise in Islam? You have fruits, you know, you have all the different types of food that the Arabs at that time would have desired that they didn't have access to. So grapes and pears and apples and all the watermelons, anything that was a rarity, they have it in paradise. And people are enticed in the Quran with these things in order that they desire to be there.
Okay.
The meat of birds, you know, and animals, it also exists there. And it was also something that people back in the day longed for and wanted. And so naturally, all of those things that they longed for and wanted would exist in paradise. The description of paradise in the Quran basically consisted of all of those things that the people that lived in the time of the Prophet Muhammad would have wanted.
Yeah.
They went long periods in the desert being hungry. They didn't have access to meat, right? And so meat is in paradise, an abundance of it. They lived in the desert, so fruits, I mean, they didn't have too much access to it, and it's something that they would have wanted and desired, along with honey and milk and all of these delicacies, all that stuff. Are in the description of paradise. And obviously, of course, they desired sex. And that is why it is a big part of the description of paradise. Not because Muhammad the Prophet was obsessed with sex, but rather the Prophet Muhammad was trying to tell people who were you know, desiring these things, and it's the human nature to want these things, and that's why it's a big part of heaven. It was as if the Quran was telling them everything that you want exists over there.
Okay.
And Ahmad al-Hassan, he says that if the Quran was to describe in this day and age, if the Quran came down today in 2023 and it was to describe to the people what exists in paradise, it would come down in a different language, and it would say something along the lines of, you know, and in there are iPhones and iPads and you know, Ferraris, and it would entice people with all of those things that they actually desire, those physical objects or those types of foods that they desire that they don't necessarily have access to here.
Yes,
you know, or
okay,
they can't afford to hear, you know, over there, all of their wishes come true.
Okay.
Yeah. But yet the sex thing would continue and it would carry on, because that is something that people of, you know, no matter what the day and age is, they always desire that. Okay?
Okay.
Because a paradise that doesn't allow people to that has any sort of restrictions is not a paradise.
Yes.
The paradise is total and absolute freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, freedom and joy and lack of suffering and all of these things that we experience in this world. It seems that from the descriptions, the paradise is the opposite.
Yeah. Exactly. And people over there, their hearts are free of any sort of hatred or envy or anything like that.
Okay.
Okay, so now let's come to the topic of where is heaven and hell? Do they have a physical location, and are they physical places? First off, we notice that all of the activities that are taking place in both heaven and hell, they are physical activities.
Yes.
There's drinking, eating, right, in both places, being tortured, body parts, all that stuff, physical.
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's a mystery.
Yeah, so that's important to know.
Yeah.
It doesn't really sound like something of the spirit. It seems like there are bodies, because hell is saying their body is regenerating, right? The narrations are saying in hell the bodies are regenerating, and then they're melting, and then they're coming back, and then they're melting, so there's a body.
Yes.
In heaven, they're enjoying things that only bodies can enjoy.
Yes, true.
Right?
Yes, they're eating.
Spirits don't eat.
Yeah.
Spirits don't drink. Spirits don't have intercourse.
Yes.
And so there has to be a body that the spirit goes into when it enters into paradise, and a body that the spirit goes into when it goes into hellfire.
Okay. It's a mysterious concept, because you think of it as a spiritual realm, but at the same time the descriptions make it clear that it's not purely spiritual, it has to be physical. So where that would possibly be
is... when we actually look, if we take away all of the words of the non-working scholars and what they're telling us, or the opinions of the scholars, and we stick to what's been written and said by the prophets and the messengers, and in the Torah, and in the Quran, and in the Bible, what do we find? We find that Adam is existing in paradise before.
Yes, in the Garden of Eden.
In the Garden of Eden. And the Garden of Eden is where?
It's there's like a description in Genesis where it's talking about the Euphrates, and people think that it's in modern day Iraq. That's where they estimate it, that it would be from that description. It's talking about the location,
exactly,
using physical aspects.
So the book of Genesis, without a shadow of a doubt, indicates that the Garden of Eden is on earth.
Yes.
And specifically in Iraq.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that is quite a mysterious thing too, because as we think about paradise as not being on this earth, but Genesis is saying that it is on the earth.
And there it is saying that it is on earth. And the Quran, when we go to it, and it describes paradise in, and basically states where its location is, and it says arduha as-samawati wal ard. Its width is the width of the heavens and the earth. Jannah arduha as-samawati wal ard.
Okay.
A paradise or a heaven whose width is the width of the heavens and the earth.
Okay, so the earth is encompassed in the...
So the earth is a part of the heaven.
Okay.
And the heaven is what is the skies, the space, the universe, and the earth.
Wow.
So everywhere, it seems, is heaven. And when we go to Al-Hafz al-Sharif and some of the mysterious sayings and hadiths that exist in the various books of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, there is this description of these different worlds. Some of the narrations talk about other planets that exist that have inhabitants that are called Jabalaka and Jabarusa. And these planets are described as being planets that the Imam is a proof over them, and planets that are filled with believers, and planets that are not using the light from the sun to light up their world, but rather enough for them is the light of the Imam.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
And narrations that describe the planet itself as having its own light, because everybody over there is a believer. And there are other narrations that state that when the punishment came down upon some of the different nations, that the believers from those nations before the punishment came down, like the people of Ad, for example, were taken away and they were placed in one of the gardens of the Lord, right? And it's basically describing another planet, one of the gardens of the Lord that exists in the universe, just like this, these planets of Jebel Lekha and Jebel Rissa.
Okay.
So there's this idea in the narrations that within the universe, there are these gardens, these planets that are literal gardens, like the Garden of Eden,
yes,
that no evil exists. Because even Mufaddal ibn Umar asks, he says, well, what about Satan? Does he affect them over there? And the answer from Imam al-Sadiq is that they don't even know that Satan exists.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's these worlds of perfection that are existing, these planets, these gardens in the universe. And then there are these other planets that are planets that used to be gardens, like the planet Earth, right?
Yeah.
And it used to be perfect and all was good. But then because of the sin of the inhabitants of the planet, the planet itself shifted from being a paradise or the Garden of Eden to being a place of suffering and torment until they pay off their karmic dues and return back to the Garden of Eden by creating a divine gestate on the planet.
Wow. So paradise can actually exist on Earth.
No, paradise is for sure on Earth.
Wow.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Wow.
And that is the goal that all of the prophets and the messengers were working towards and for. A return of the Earth to that Garden of Eden.
Wow.
It is a, there's this tug of war, then this picture emerges of this tug of war that's taking place between two forces, the forces of heaven and the forces of hell, the forces of good and the forces of evil, the forces of God and the forces of Satan,
yes,
the forces of all of those positive good traits, right? And all of those evil traits. And light and darkness. And so the planets of the entire universe and the universe itself becomes this battlefield where there's these realms and planets and places in the universe that are part of heaven and they don't even know what's going on. They're totally oblivious to even the fight that's taking place because they're in realms of bliss and their planets are perfect and the mere idea of rebelling against God does not even exist. And then you have these other planets that are filled with darkness and evil and they're more like, hellish type places to live. And then there's these places that are in between like the planet Earth. And so now that leaves us with the question of, okay, well, then where is hell? Is it also, like within our universe? And the answer is also in the Quran because it says that hellfire is surrounding the disbelievers.
Okay.
Hellfire is surrounding the disbelievers.
Okay.
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 It's a place that's fire. That's surrounding the disbelievers. And a person needs to go no further except to go outside and to look into the sky during the day and to feel the heat from the sun and to realize that the sun is a ball of fire that makes the days so hot sometimes and unbearable on earth that people say it's hotter than hell here. Right?
Yeah.
And every day it is surrounding the disbelievers. Every day it is in the sky, passing by.
Wow.
The sun is hellfire.
Wow.
And the earth is heaven. if we can just turn it back, go back into the frequency that it once human beings used to be tuned into.
Wow. I mean, that's a really fascinating explanation of this very deep topic. And I think that you've answered the questions that many people have. I mean, the question of where is heaven and where is the hellfire? And these are questions that, nobody has really been able to provide a satisfying answer for. And you've made the whole story make sense. And yeah, I have no words to describe how amazing this knowledge is that you've spoken about today.
You know, there's a lot more that can be said about these worlds. And there's so much detail that's involved in, you know, the description of each and every one of them. We'll stop right there. And inshallah, if people are interested, we can definitely, in future episodes, go over all of the rest of the amazing things that take place in heaven and hell.
Well, I can't wait to learn more. Thank you so much for everything that you've taught me today.
God bless you.
God bless you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.